that you will find out as a result of meditation is that that is exactly what you do. You find yourself at one with, for lack of a better terminology, a supreme spirit, that is the unborn, the undying, and the uncreated. The XYZ, the he, she, it. And many Zenists have been frightened off of calling it anything whatsoever for precisely the reason that if they call it something, it immediately brings up in the mind a picture which is wrong. So they call it nothing. But you see, you can't call it nothing because that is much too negative. If you call something nothing, then where are you going as a result of meditation, if it isn't into some weird oblivion, a rather scary oblivion? But you're not going into any oblivion at all. That nothing is the fullest nothing I have ever met with. There's so much in there, it's incredible. But how do you explain it? So if you know what I am talking about when I call it the cosmic Buddha, and please don't get hurt by the terminology, I think you will be able to understand better what Dogen is talking about here. The most important question for all Buddhists is how to understand birth and death completely. So you come to meditate not because you're getting mad at the world and mad with your parents. You have come to meditate because there is something in you that is not completely happy with the way in which you personally are. Most people, if they analyze this with great care, discover that what is really wrong is that they are either scared of living or they're scared of dying. They don't like boiling it down to those two questions, but that is actually what it comes out as. How can I deal with my daily affairs? Maybe meditation will help. How do I deal with the fact that I am getting older? After all, what is the meaning of life? All of these things, if you think about them carefully, boil down to how do I deal with life and how do I deal with death? And Dogen says quite clearly, the most important question for all Buddhists is how to understand birth and death, how to understand the purpose of being alive, how to understand the purpose of dying. For dying is not a punishment, and birth is not a punishment. They are two simple positions in time, which I shall go into in much greater length later on. So, should you be able to find the Buddha within birth and death, i.e., should you be able to find the unborn, the undying, and the uncreated, then birth and death vanish. For you see, there is this thing that is beyond them, which is the real, true life. What we are living at the present moment is the dream. When you find this place, you know that what is going on here and now doesn't matter, and you know that what happens at death doesn't matter, because there is nothing that is born, and there is nothing that can die. Therefore, since you cannot lose anything, and since you cannot gain anything, you lose all fear. And thus the person who has studied meditation properly can stay in this exquisite place, which is called the place of the Buddha, or the place of the cosmic Buddha. The place in which there is nothing that is born, nothing that dies, nothing that is created. The place of Supreme Spirit, place of God, whatever you like to call it. That is finding the Buddha within birth and death. That is what you really come to meditate to find. You do not come to meditate in order to be able to make more money, in order to feel better, in order to be able to put up with your husband or your wife or your kids or the boss. You come because you want to find the Buddha, which will then release you from the fears of life and the fears of death. So if you can understand that before you ever start to meditate, you know what it is you are trying to do. Too many people sit down and look at a wall and they haven't a clue what it is they're trying to do. And they sit there and say, well, I'm an ass. Here I am sitting looking at a wall, and they're sort of counting their fingers or counting the knobs and counting the knots in the wood on the wall or swearing about the state their feet are in. But the purpose they have come there for is, if you like, to be reunited with God. Now, in Christianity, you have the saying, many are called, but few chosen. Buddhism has a different version of it. All are called, but few answer. That means, this expresses a very true Buddhist sentiment. Every single one of us has a knowledge of the cosmic Buddha. Every single one of us has already within us the true spirit of the Buddha. All that we have to do is re-find it, because as a result of our general education and a lot of other things, we have been very carefully and neatly brainwashed out of it. We have brainwashed ourselves out of it. Our environment has dealt with it, has got rid of it for us. Our education has got rid of it. Our parents have got rid of it. And around the age of 7, we had this feeling of loss, which we always somehow could remember having had it at some time, but couldn't quite remember when, and a yearning to get back to it. What Zen will do is teach you how to get back to it in its meditation. But it is not, you will never make it without meditation, and meditation, although it is in of itself enough, in one sense, it is not enough, because you do need to talk about what you're doing to make sure you're not doing it wrong. So although pure meditation of itself is quite enough, without talking about it, mistakes can be made, and sometimes are. So, finding the Buddha within birth and death, both birth and death vanish. For all you have to do is realize that birth and death, as such, should not be avoided, and they will cease to exist. In other words, just live and just die. But don't think that this is the living that we are doing right now and the dying that we are doing right now. The true living is to be found within the cosmic Buddha. So long as we get our own theories and our own ideas in the way, we will not find that place. So long as all we do is just worry about external things, we will never find this place. By the way, can you all hear me clearly? Right. So long as you do not live from your center, but from external things, you will not find this place. This is why in Soto Zen, we sit and look at a wall, so that we shall not be bugged by external things. Now, I'd like to go briefly into the actual physical way of doing meditation. First of all, you do not need to twist yourself up on the floor like a pretzel. There is no need for that. What you do need to do is to be sure that your back is straight. By straight, I mean it must have the shape of a properly aligned spine. I'm sure you've all seen charts of skeletons, pictures of skeletons, and the way in which a spine looks. Anybody not seen what a spine looks like? I'm sure everybody has. That is called a straight spine. It is the most unstraight thing I've ever seen, but it is called a straight spine in Zen, right? That is how your spine has to be. Normal. It mustn't be slouching. It mustn't be lying back. It has to be straight. The best way to do it is either on a stool or on the floor. If you haven't got a stool, use a fairly wide chair. These are rather good chairs, actually, so we're not going to have a problem. Use a fairly wide chair and do not sit against the back of it. Sit forward so that your legs are not being restricted by the chair itself. Would you pull that chair forward, Kyogen, and sit on it properly so that they can see? Yeah, so that people can all see how. It's very important if you're wearing trousers to not sit on the floor. You note that only a small piece of him is on the chair. Because otherwise, the blood vessels under the thighs are going to get badly restricted. And then your feet are going to go to sleep. Or worse still, your feet are going to swell, which is most unpleasant. If you're on the floor, you can twist yourself up. And a lot of younger people prefer to do that. Got to the state when I prefer the chair. And I have been a professional at it for years, and I'm not ashamed of saying I prefer the chair. So. Yes, go ahead.
Two comments about this chair. I think these are going to be the same. One is that it's a little low, so that the knees are higher than the hips, which is not advisable. The other problem is the arms are...
Yeah, the arms worried me a bit. You do want something without arms because you want your... Well, I'm all right in this one.
Perhaps those wooden ones might be...
Unless you would like to sit on the floor, in which case...
We
brought the cushions for you to use. Right. That is the first thing. You do not have to twist yourself up. You do have to make sure your spine is right. The next thing you must be sure of is your head. Make sure that it is comfortable. Don't lean it forward, don't hang it back. It must be in such a way on your neck that you almost do not notice that it's there. It must be weightless. Just let it settle wherever is right for you as an individual. No two people have exactly the same place for putting their head. If we were all exactly the same height, the same weight, the same length of arm and the same length of leg, we could make a blueprint as to how to do this. But every book on meditation has to be an approximation. Because someone with long legs is going to have to sit on a different cushion, a much heavier one than someone with short legs. And someone with a heavier head is going to have to carry it in a slightly different position from someone with a light head. I'm talking now physically in weight. You really have to be very careful that you do not think that because one person looks so much different to you that you are necessarily doing it wrong. Supposing you have, as in one case of one of the monks in Shasta, supposing you've had polio and your spine is fused incorrectly, then you sit as well as you possibly can. The beauty of the cosmic Buddha is that he doesn't hold it against you that you've been sick. But he also does not expect you to twist yourself up in such a way that you will make yourself sicker. So do not try to do that which is unnatural. Next thing is where to put your eyes. Do not close the eyes. As we go through this course, you will see why it is most unwise to close them. It's a very, very long subject and will probably take a whole session to explain. So please take it from me at the moment, because otherwise we'll get things out of whack. The eyes should be lowered comfortably. If you are a spectacle wearer normally, do not take your spectacles off. You are not trying to make yourself feel weird or different. You are attempting to become normal, completely normal, and to return to that which is truly normal for all living beings. So don't try to become something different. If you're a spectacle wearer, find where your eyes rest comfortably on the floor, or if you're sitting here, comfortably on the table, and just choose a spot and go with it. Don't try to strain them. Don't try to see a specific spot. Just find where they rest naturally. One of the things that it says in the information in this book on how to do meditation is about 3 meters is the right distance for sitting, which tells us a lot about Dogen's own eyesight. He could see comfortably at a distance of 3 meters, but not everybody can. The purpose is finding the place where you can see comfortably and settling for that. Next thing, do not get worried by sounds and noises or things on the carpet or things on the table. These things can only disturb your meditation if you allow them to disturb the meditation. For example, you can say, oh, there's a dog barking and it's a confounded nuisance. Or you can say, there's a dog barking. If you merely say there's a dog barking, it's not going to disturb you. You've merely noticed that there is a dog barking because your ears are not closed or plugged up. If you say it's a nuisance, you have already made a judgment on the dog and you've already stopped meditating because you're thinking about the dog. Do you understand what I'm saying? The difference between deliberate thought and natural thought. And this brings me to what is the most important point in meditation. Do not specially try to think. But don't try not to think. You are not trying to cut thinking off. You are merely trying to get beyond being worried by it. Of course thoughts are going to wander through your head. You're going to feel stray itches and you're going to have a sneeze occasionally and somebody's going to cough and somebody else is going to fidget slightly, finding the right place to sit. None of these things can disturb you unless you permit them to disturb you. If you permit them to, they'll do a marvelous job of it. Just don't worry about them. It's as if you're sitting beneath a bridge. Over the bridge goes a big freeway with things going in all directions, and you're sitting underneath the freeway, and there's all this racket going on, and you're just watching the beautiful river meandering by. Now, you can climb up the bridge, onto the bridge, if you're bored, and get either hijacked or thumb a lift in one of the thoughts that's going back and forth. You understand what I'm getting at. Or you can stay down, sitting quietly beside the river, and the thoughts will go back and forth on the road up above, but you will not be disturbed because you will be in this third place. You will be in this place where lives the cosmic Buddha. So when you get beyond these two sides, when you get beyond being bothered by the thoughts, you are already beginning to find that place wherein the cosmic Buddha dwells. Now, people say you should count your breaths, or you should do this, or you should do that. Counting breaths is useful if you can't stop your brain from being noisy. If you do not have a noisy brain, counting breaths makes the brain noisy, and that is just what you do not want to happen. So don't bring it, cause yourself a problem when you haven't got one. It would be the same as a phrenologist who couldn't find a bump to read, so took a hammer to the man's head and produced one in order to be able to read it. There's a complete waste of time. Don't do it. If your mind is not a busy mind, don't worry with whether you should count breaths or not. Just sit still. If it gets noisy, then have a word with me or one of the monks who's going to be helping to put you to make sure you can sit correctly. If that happens, then have a word with us and we'll explain what to do. But there is no point in doing something if you haven't got it as a problem. Right. How to breathe correctly. Do not try to breathe abnormally. Whatever is normal for you is right breathing. Dogen says one must harmonize the breath with the rest of the body. That means do not allow it to become coarse. Don't hyperventilate. Don't get involved in the breathing. Just let the breathing be normal. Let it harmonize with the rest of the body. Everything is in harmony as it normally is. You need to take at the beginning two or three really good deep breaths to make sure that your nose isn't stuffed up and that all passages are open and you can breathe comfortably and normally. But you do not spend the rest of the time trying to take different types of breaths from what you have normally taken. Take whatever size breath is normal for you after you have done two or three deep ones. Now, there is a reason, as there is another reason for taking these deep breaths. And that is, you have to set up what the Taoists call the backward flowing motion, and which the Buddhists call the turning of the wheel. The wheel is simply the circulation of the breath. At the area of the coccyx, base of the spine, is the place where the in-breath starts from. It changes at the top of the head to exhalation and comes down the front. So when you take your deep breaths, you set up a sort of wheel. Up the back, inhalation, down the front, exhalation. Up the back, inhalation, down the front, exhalation. You then do not spend the rest of the meditation period worrying as to whether the breath is going in that direction or not. Having set up the two or three breaths that tell you that that is how the breathing is done in meditation, you leave it to go of its own free will. And it will. You do not need to do any more than to set it up. Within this area of the back, about the area of the kidneys, is the seat of the will. It is the will that enforces the desire, reinforces the desire for meditation. If you feel despair, it is that area which causes you to slump. If you are eager and alert to meditate, it is that area which seems to work as a sort of dynamo to get you going. Therefore, it is that area from which, if you are sitting properly, the feeling of energy coming up comes from. Because that is the area where the will is situated. At a later date, I can give you proofs of this. You're going to have to take it on trust for today whilst we're learning the art of meditation, okay? So, you are sitting thus. You note where the breath comes from. You pick up the breath with the will. You bring it to the top. And it comes back down almost like a shower, like a fountain shower over the body. You do this two or three times, and then you just sit quietly, allowing it to happen naturally, with the mind bright, not trying to think, not trying not to think, not grabbing at thoughts, not pushing them away. If a thought comes up, it's a darn nuisance, that dog. Oh, I must push that thought away. You've already taken it two more down the line. If it comes up that the dog is a nuisance, then just go on from there. Do not try complicating it by complaining to yourself that you complained about the dog being a nuisance. Do not make the thing into a chain of complaint. Have I not covered anything?
Hands,
thank you. How to hold the hands in meditation. There are various things that I'm sure you have heard of, various mudras. They are explained in the Book of Life here, which we shall go into later. That, for the time being, we will leave. The only thing that we will be doing is the meditation one. If you are right-handed, put your right hand under your left. If you are left-handed, put your right hand over your left. Now, this is done solely so as to make sure that you do not tense up your body. You see, if you're sitting like this comfortably with your hands in your lap, and a teacher, a meditation teacher, comes by, and he sees you, your nails going white, he knows that you're all tensed up. If he only sees them touching lightly and they're a nice normal pink color, he knows that you're sitting properly and all this part of you is relaxed. So the whole purpose of this is to tell the teacher whether or not you are relaxed enough to be able to sit comfortably. The reason for left over right and right over left is that whichever side of the body is the most active should be kept a little quieter, and therefore the less active is superimposed over the more active. That's the only purpose for that. There are other reasons for having the hands like this which will become apparent as we go along. But for the time being, it is important that you learn not to tense yourselves up in the way in which you hold your hands. Now, I know that you are going to find that as we go along, I will seem to keep giving you more information about various points. This is not something that you can give in one lecture. Every time you meditate, every time you settle down to work in this way, you will discover something new. And the Zen master is very much like a mother feeding a child. She is glad and happy to feed it steak when it can eat steak. But since at the age of 3 months, shall we say, the most it can manage is strained baby foods, that's what you get. In meditation stage one, which is what we're doing now, which also happens to be all the stages of meditation rolled into one, but you can't see that until you've gone all four of them. In meditation stage one, it will look as though at a later date I have not told you everything. And you're darned right, I haven't. But I cannot tell you everything when you begin. You have to find out a tremendous amount for yourself. Just keep your minds open and do not hold it against me that at a later date I am going to say something more or what may seem to be something different. Because all I am doing is telling you as much as can be done at this stage. Fair enough? Right, now, let's see. How many want to try sitting on the ground and how many want to try sitting on chairs? Okay, would those who opt for chairs, shall we say, come to this end of the room? And those who opt for a wall, let's go to this end where there's a wall. And would you help, please, with... What I recommend people to do is, if they can sit for 10 minutes comfortably, push themselves to 11 or 12 minutes, just so that they discipline themselves a little. And when that's comfortable, push themselves to 13 or 14 minutes, when that's comfortable, and so on. But never push it longer than 45 minutes. The most experienced of Zen masters never sits for longer than 45 minutes. For the very simple reason that you can get very dull in the head if you tend to sit longer than that. The normal process and the normal meditation system is to sit for 45 minutes, take a quarter of an hour walking about and exercising the body a little, just walking about quietly. If need be, use the toilet, etc. And then go back to sitting down for another 45 minutes, then walk about for another 15. And this has been proved both by the Buddha and by all the monks that were ever any real good since that time to be the best system, and since it worked for them, I don't see why we shouldn't use the same system. But don't force yourself longer than you really can. I know I have a lot of people here who have been doing it for a fair number of years, and that means that I occasionally, forgive me, forget that perhaps I have someone who has not done it before. Anyone else have trouble?
Yes, I do. My feet like to sleep, my trousers.
Ah, yes. Either, if you could next time bring either a pair of very, very baggy ones, you know, sort of like culotte type, or else wear a very loose skirt. Doesn't really matter which, but you do have to be sure that they are loose. Yeah. Otherwise, you just restrict the circulation.
I had to change position.
Yeah. Don't feel worried about changing position in the middle of meditation. I actually tell people, if they're in the middle of a session in which we are sitting for 45 minutes and this is their first time and they're really not used to it, don't feel guilty about moving your feet. And if you really can't stand it, don't feel guilty about getting up and walking out for a few minutes. Because you're not attempting to do an endurance test. You are not doing something something like, look how brave I am. I can sit here for days and days and then can't walk. That's not the purpose of it. The purpose of it is to find the cosmic Buddha, to find this wonderfully peaceful, beautifully alive state. And if your feet are half dead and you're worrying about them, you're not going to do that. You're going to be swearing about meditation. Do not get it to the state when you can't stand the thought of meditating. I have seen people driven to that, and it's very, very sad. Really sincere people who have been literally driven by a teacher to hating meditation or dreading the hour of it because they got to sit for a specific length of time and could not move. Which brings me to another important point when you're practicing at home, and that is don't get yourselves feeling guilty if you miss a meditation period. Guilt is the worst and most dangerous thing, state you can get into when you're studying. If you miss a time, and since you're all out in the world at work, you are going to miss a meditation sometime or other. Since that is going to happen, recognize the fact that you are human, that you are occasionally going to miss a meditation, and say, all right, that is not going to make me swear about it and say, oh, well, I've missed yesterday, so what's the point, etc., etc. Or worse still, I have known people say, well, I missed yesterday, so what's the point of doing it today? And then they miss 2 days, and so it goes on. Don't do that. If you miss one, right, you missed it. Carry straight on as if you hadn't, and just go to the next one. And you can always put your mind into a sort of meditative state. I have warned people many times to do this. Instead of sitting at red lights complaining that they don't change and this sort of thing, you can put your mind just quietly and say, all right, the red light on, so I'll meditate for a couple of minutes. There are a million minutes in the day when you can put in a spot of meditation, which can be very valuable, provided you are not stuck with the idea that you've got to sit on the floor, tied up like a pretzel, or that you've got to have a specific place. The art of learning to meditate is to be able to be one with the cosmic Buddha at all times of the day and night. And that includes when you're out on the freeway, and when you're at home, and when you're at work. It's to find this place where you are completely at peace with yourself and the rest of the world. To find the place where the opposites don't exist. Therefore, you have to be able to find it at all times and in all places. So why not start with all places, at all times? You're always getting 2 or 3 minutes during the day when you can spend just being still, just being quiet. Among many other advantages that meditation gives you, But you should understand that these are bonuses. They are not the purpose for which you meditate. Is that meditation does very definitely lessen the possibility of high blood pressure. And in this day and age, high blood pressure is a very likely thing to get. But that is only a bonus. The purpose you are doing it for is to re-find the cosmic Buddha. Now, I'd like to hear any questions you've got on the meditation you had. Anything that might have... yes, go ahead.
I was terribly bored, and I found myself wanting to watch the thoughts and go with them for entertainment.
Yes.
You know? And I wonder if I should be counting my breaths or something.
You can try it if you wish. All you have to do is never count beyond 10 breaths, all right? Count one, which is on the in-breath, out. Two, out. Three, out. And if you find that you get hijacked, if the thoughts hijack you, then start at one again. Don't go on. Never go beyond 10. Now, don't continue that practice for years and years and years. I've known people do that. Because in the end, it can get very much in your way. Only continue it until the thoughts stop grabbing you. And every now and then, perhaps every 2 or 3 days, check to see if you're getting on top of the thing. Because it's you that has to make the running. You that has to do all the work on you. And after about a week or two, that should stop. Don't get worried if it doesn't. I had one professor type once who it took 4 years for. His brain was running around so fast. He was like 10 men and a wee fellow trying to catch it. That can happen. So don't feel hurt if it doesn't go away in 2 weeks, all right? But it should be lessening. Okay? Yes.
Roshi, could you talk some more about guilt, since you were saying, since it's so rampant and on the other extreme?
And what way do you want me to talk about it?
I think you were saying how useless it is and what it does to us, what it does to the meditation.
In Buddhism, there is no such thing as original sin. Unlike Christianity, I don't know if they have original sin in Judaism, I believe they do.
What we heard last time was that they don't.
Well, I keep hearing from different people they do and they don't, and I'm trying to see what's the general feel of this bunch. Okay, they don't, right. Well, most of us have come out of Christianity, or those of us who have come out of Christianity, have been given the doctrine of original sin. Now, there is no first parent who sinned in such a way that we have picked up that sin. Buddhism believes in rebirth, which is quite different from the Christian idea. We are born, as we are, with what we have collected up in past lives of karma. Now, on Thursday, I shall be going into karma with great detail. Generally speaking, karma is thought of as cause and effect. If I do such and such, such and such will result. Karma is actually that stuff which causes us to be born on this particular plane. Buddhism has a large number of planes of existence. This particular plane on which we are born, as humans or animals and the like, requires 5 aggregates, as they are called, to produce a human being. Form or matter, perceptions, thoughts,
activity or inclination.
Activity or inclination and consciousness. Right. Now, you can have all of these, but without consciousness, nothing's going to happen. And karma is what causes consciousness on this plane. When we have cleaned up all of the karma, then there is no further purpose for existence on this plane. You are still in existence. Do not suffer from the idea that having cleaned up all the karma and all the good part of you having gone back to the cosmic Buddha, then this thing that's left is dirty. That isn't true. What is left is still the pure essence of the cosmic Buddha, which may take a little longer to get there than certain other parts. The karma which we are born with, which we have collected up from past lives, is the nearest thing that one gets to original sin. But one is not guilty as a result of collecting up karma. Karma is like a perfume. If you, for example, suppose you go out and buy some fish and you bring it home in a bag and you eat the fish, at a later date, the bag may smell of fish. Therefore, everybody knows that you have fish in this bag, but there is now no fish. Right. So karma is like a perfume. You are perfumed with what you were, but it is not you. Therefore, you carry around your bag of stinking fish until you do something about it. But it is not something you have to be guilty about. It is something like washing out the bag.
May I make a comment on this?
On a sort of
daily basis, yeah. and bring it down to when you're sitting and you make a mistake or you find your mind has wandered and why there's no guilt attached. It's a little bit like if you're driving from here to San Francisco and you get on the freeway going the wrong way by accident. Well, you've made a mistake, and you don't feel guilty about that. You get off and you get back on and you go the right way.
And you don't swear about it either.
Right. Yeah. Then karma is rather like that. It's as if you make certain mistakes and the car has ended up going the wrong way, or it happens to be here and you're all heading for San Francisco, if we can liken that to Nirvana. And so where you find yourself at this particular moment is the karma up to this time. So you just keep trying, you keep turning and heading towards San Francisco. Now, it's the idea of karma being transferred from life to life is rather like when someone dies, well, here's this car that's sitting here on the street, and someone else gets in and starts driving it. It's a different person, and he has no more guilt than the last person who made a wrong turn, but it's his duty to get the car to San Francisco. And it works rather like that. And see, your karma from day to day is no different from the karma from life to life. Here you are. This is where we are. There's no use arguing about it. Let's go to San Francisco.
Don't sit and worry about who was driving previously. Yeah. Car itself doesn't matter. What matters is who's driving. Doesn't matter what the car is. Does that help you at all?
It sort of points to the fact that it slows down. I mean, it was like a distraction. Guilt is a real distraction. Just slowing down.
You see, you can't be blamed for the fact that the bag you happen to be carrying stinks of fish. You can be blamed if you don't wash it. But it's not your fault that it smells of fish. You did not perfume it with fish. The fish perfumed it with fish.
Likewise, you don't have to go around stuffing more fish in it.
Well,
go ahead.
Does the person put the fish in the bag in the beginning, to begin with?
If he's carrying around a bag that he's got from somebody else that stinks of fish, he didn't put the fish in it.
No.
But if he puts more fish in, then he's responsible for the fact that it stinks of fish.
It's like saying, oh, I have a fish bag, so therefore I must put fish in it.
You have to accept the fish.
Yes. That's all. You see, people feel they've picked up this stuff, or I've inherited this from somewhere. But there's no guilt attached to the inheriting of it. That's the important point. The guilt is feeling that it's your responsibility. I did not do what Eve did. But the Christians say, well, because Eve did it, it's your doing. No, it isn't, says Buddhism.
Can I make this, bring this? There's a further step in Buddhism which must be understood, if this is to be understood clearly, which is that you today, in this moment, do no more than inherit the karma of yesterday or the previous moment. And in that sense, you are a pure new being right now who has inherited the karma of the being that was yesterday. So in one sense, you are no more the you that was yesterday than you are the person 100 years ago that set karma in motion. And that's why there is no guilt. Just cause and effect. Each moment is new.
But you still have the klesa. It's interesting that the word in Buddhism for it is klesa, which literally means perfume or smell. The smell of the previous being, the smell of the past. It's a very good description of it.
Is it possible to be so afraid of making bad karma that one just doesn't move in any direction at all, or very little, or doesn't take risks, or...
Well, you're making karma either way. You see, if you won't take risks when you should take risks, then you've made karma by not taking risks. You really can't escape the thing. Somebody was saying to me the other day, how did Buddhists feel about going to war? And were they pacifists and the like? And I said, well, look, the Buddhist point on this is simply, if the government calls you up and you go, you must accept the karma of killing, because you are breaking the precepts and you are killing others. If the government calls you up and you refuse to go, then you must accept the karma of refusing to go. Either way, there is going to be cause and effect. And there is not going to be a middleman who is going to say, you should do this or you should do not. You should do it or you should not do it. There is simply going to be, if you go, yes, you will break a precept and must accept the karma of that. If you do not go, then yes, you break a are breaking the law, and you may also be breaking a precept. Supposing you have got, shall we say, another Hitler kicking around, and you don't go to war and stop him, how many more people are going to die because you didn't do anything? And then you've got the thing complicated that way. In other words, Buddhism will not take away your responsibility. It will not give you a savior to say, well, I'll take all the consequences on me. It's going to say, oh no, the buck stops with you.
So you just try to do the best you can?
You do the very, very best you can at all times. And very responsibly. You cannot just do things on the spur of the moment without taking very great care as to what you are doing, because you are going to be held absolutely responsible for what you do. It's a hard road, but in the end it's the only adult one that I really know of. It's not a religion for spiritual children. It's a religion for spiritual adults. Quite different thing from having someone to take the responsibility for you. Anything more on meditation while we're at this particular one? Yes. I mean, we're getting into next week.
I learned a form of meditation where you close your eyes and use mantra.
Yeah.
I've done it long enough that I can't sit still without...
Oh, don't worry about that. Don't worry about that. It'll go eventually if you keep at it. It'll
also
stop.
My eyes, both the hour of the day and habit, I think.
Yes, it's just habit, and it'll go. If you worry about it, it will get more set. If you don't worry about it, it'll eventually go away. It's one of these peculiar things that if you sort of try and push it away, it grabs you. Haven't you ever noticed that when you don't want a cat on your lap, it'll insist on coming and rubbing itself against you? It works just like that.
The last thing is that my back hurt quite a bit, which it does off and on during the day. But this hurt quite a lot, and I know that it's not supposed to.
Well,
maybe I should just go see the cure for my
back. Well, this may be the cure for your back. That's something else that come up.
One thing that happens at the process of sitting itself it's actually a yoga exercise. It can help stretch the back, it stretches the legs. Many things can improve from doing it.
And as you go along, as we go along, you'll discover that body and mind, or body and spirit, whichever way you like to look at it, are so interwoven that perhaps just doing the meditation is bringing up something that needs to be attended to, and which can be attended to in meditation, which is another side of the thing. A lot of aches and pains that we have, meditation will bring up and make almost excruciating, because it wants us to look at them very clearly. You see, when you sit your body properly, when you get the spine right and all the other parts of it correct, you are virtually opening up all the little nerves and orifices and everything for it to work normally and correctly. And then all the stuff from the past, both physical and mental, is going to come back, because your body has memories in every little part of you. You know how a musician seems to have memories in his fingers for where the notes are? Well, all of your body has memories, all parts of it, for various things. And if you meditate, you can get in touch with those memories, and it's quite startling what you can find out. For example, after you've meditated for a fair amount of time, if you've had an operation and you work on the scar, you can actually hear what the doctors and nurses were talking about at the time of doing it. That part of you has retained the memory. Now, this may seem remarkable, but it's fact. You can pick up some incredible things. Yes.
Memories are tied up in nerve bundles and muscles.
And you see, it will also frequently show you the cause of allergies, or what you thought were allergies. Well, don't worry. Meditation actually does some quite incredible things if you do it properly. But all it really does is align everything up right, so that all the doors open up. They're all there anyway. All you're doing is just opening it all up and listening and discussing with all the pieces of you. And you realize how closely the spirit is involved in every single pore of the body. It's not just in here. It's almost as though each piece of you has its own private line, and its own separate storehouse. You know, like a telephone exchange, and it's got its own information for everything that ever happened to it.
That sets me up for using it.
Yes, it can. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, along the same line, with me, oftentimes, like, emotions come up, and, like, I'll find what would naturally happen is I would start crying. Yeah. And I can force myself to stop that, which doesn't seem that healthy.
Usually when one first starts to meditate, or when one hasn't been at it too long, or even if one's been at it a fair time and hasn't had much help with what's going on or been told much of what's going on, the coarser side of the emotions will come up, like a lot of crying, a lot of deep grief, a lot of deep fear, this sort of thing. And the more once one's been taught how to handle that, then the less coarse things come up much more subtly.
So what do you recommend doing?
How long have you been meditating?
Well, on and off for several years, and regularly just for a few minutes.
Have you possibly dug deep enough for something quite rather larger than usual to be actually coming up? Do you live in Berkeley?
Mm-hmm.
Could you come and see us at the Priory sometime? Because it's actually going to be a rather private matter and you probably won't want it dug up in public. Might be a good idea. In the meantime, I strongly recommend you read this thing, The Book of Life, which can explain an awful lot of what's happening. And part of which, have you all got this, by the way?
A young child becoming separated from unity with the cosmic people.
Mm-hmm.
About the age of 7.
Or thinking that it is. Nobody actually is ever separated. What we do, out of this comes the danger of thinking that we are unclean, or that there is something in us that is permanently unclean, which is not true. From about the age of 7, we start agreeing with others around us, instead of keeping to our own true beliefs of what we know is right and wrong. We get caught by our peers by about that age. Many people get caught a lot earlier, though. I've known children caught as early as 2. And just going along with things for peace and quiet. But inside, they know they're wrong, and something gets steadily saddened as that happens. I wrote a chapter about it in the Book of Life.
Something very curious about that, too. My way of thinking is that when I was raised in the Catholic tradition, they explained to us that at the age of 7 we had reached the age of reason, which allowed us to take First Communion.
You thought also as they did, in other words.
I'm sorry. The first step to taking First Communion was taking confession.
Yeah.
I wondered if this is a recognition of the same problem or a sort of...
I think it's a recognition of the same problem from a slightly different point of view. Certainly a child from about 7 knows when it's doing right and wrong. It's got right and wrong very firmly established in its mind. But we tend to think only in terms of right and wrong. Before that, it knew the cosmic Buddha. Now, with any luck, it still knows the cosmic Buddha, but it's got right and wrong in there as well. It's conceivably possible, in fact, I know it happens, that after a bit they lose the cosmic Buddha and just keep the right and wrong, or seem to lose the cosmic Buddha. Do you know what I'm saying? And they get stuck in this duality of should I, shouldn't I, all in their heads, instead of staying still in their own hearts and knowing what is right and what is not, what is true and what is not, what is real and what is not, which doesn't stop you knowing right and wrong. It stops you being a slave to them and being worried in your own mind by them. Okay? You seem to lose this nice third thing when you're about 7, if you're not careful.
What is it that would cause a child to lose it? Would it be worries or illness?
I think it comes out of buying an adult world, buying our values. rather than staying with the true beauty of knowing what is real and knowing what is not. I can give you a case in point. A small child will love a furry animal or love a tree or a butterfly. It's beauty. I'm not talking about the sort now that pulls them to bits. It may do that too without them not knowing what it's doing. But it will also admire and love. As it gets older, a cheap tin tray is of more importance and something to pay for rather than to go and get a kitten or to... After all, this was made by man. The kitten was only an example of the cosmic Buddha. Do you see what I mean? The value changes.
I know what you mean because of the boy in our neighborhood. He told his mother that she was beautiful. She said, oh, thank you. She said, just like that dog next door.
Right.
And that was a source of great humor to the adults, but to the child.
But,
perfectly.
And was probably very hurt because they laughed. Yes. That's exactly what I'm talking about. There's another child or two up at the Abbey who have been taught, who've been sitting in meditation with his parents, and the parents were having a fight one night. And he looked up and said, you know, Mummy, you need to get back to your secret place where we are in meditation. And the parents stopped the fight very fast. But the point was over. The child knew where that place was, and they were beginning to lose it. That's exactly what we were talking about. I was out at what they call the name of the place, Africa, USA, down in Menlo Park.
Marine World.
And I was introduced to a chimp because someone I know happens to be a friend of the boss. And the chimp liked me very much and did me the very great honor of looking for fleas in my hair. It was a very great honor. It was a great deal of love in the way in which it was feeling. And it understood and it was expecting me to look for them in it. This was not something comical or monkeyish.
Do you think that animals can express gratitude?
Oh, can they ever?
I have felt that they do.
They can do it far better than we can and frequently do. Because there is a purity there. Which the child has, which is what we are talking about. It's that purity, which is the cosmic Buddha, the isness, and which they lose as they become sophisticated. And one of the beauties of Zen is it teaches you how to find that again. And then it also teaches you how to fit a watertight door on it so that you can look out and enjoy it and close it before the rest of the world gets in to try and tear the wings off the butterfly. Yes.
Well, I'm a little bit confused, or I don't know whether that's the right word, about the elevation of the child here, because it's a little more complicated than that, don't you think? I mean,
yes.
They're also very self-centered.
It is much more complicated
not,
than that.
I mean, they come from sort of two different places.
Don't misunderstand me. I am not talking now about the karma that it has brought with it, which is what you are worried about. I'm talking about the pure part of it that it has got. And a very large part of it is that. Then it can add to the store of the nastiness, which you're talking about, the self-centeredness, which comes out of the karma which it has brought with it, and in fact is the manifestation of that karma. As a result of our teaching it to come out of that pure state, we can then teach it to put more fish in an already fishy bag. And what we have to do is be very careful that we do not teach it to do that. We have to teach it how to wash the bag out, not to continue to put more fish in. Yes, you're completely right. But that is exactly why you have this problem with children. They have come from this incredibly pure thing, bringing with them this bag of fish. Dead fish. The smell of which there is nothing worse. Does that answer your...
Yes,
yes.
I understand that.
Yeah. It seems like that children come with the ability to be childlike, but they're taught how to be childish.
Yes, I'm afraid they are. frequently by childish adults who have, need their ears boxed.
I was thinking, because this child idea came up, in Christianity, a lot of the things that this has said, well...
Unless you become as little children.
Unless you become little children, you shall not enter the kingdom, and things like that. It's interesting.
Which is true, because that's the state you have to get to in Zen. You cannot find the so-called nirvana of Zen, which is really finding the cosmic Buddha, unless you become completely naive. But that doesn't mean you become childish. It doesn't mean that you go back to the state that our friend was worried about here, of carrying around the dirty stuff as well. You've got to get rid of all of that. You do not become as a little child. You become as a little child without his karma, which is quite a different thing from a little child. Totally different thing.
I would just like to say one more thing about that. Is it maybe possible that it's necessary to make a free decision about going back to that place rather than just being it from birth? And that a seven-year-old child or a six-year-old child can't make a free decision.
I think that that is very important. I think that the person has to make that decision. I also think it is incumbent upon the adult not to give the kid so much more extra fish that it looks at the amount it's got in the bag and says, forget it this time round, which is what a lot of us do. I feel that it's our duty not necessarily to keep them in that state, but at least not to place so much more in their way of making the decision if they wish to. Yes, I would agree with you. That is why some people seem to have so much more good fortune, shall we say, than others. And some seem to have so much less. It explains the inequalities of the world.
There is good karma.
Oh, yes.
We can create good
karma. Oh, yes. We very definitely can create good karma.
There
are two forms, kusala and akusala, and I can never remember which is good or bad, but you can definitely have both.
You're not necessarily at an advantage though by having a lot of the good, in quotes.
What did you say?
You're not necessarily at an advantage by having a lot of the good, in quotes, karma. Because when you meditate, you work with what you've got. And
you haven't got anything else to work with.
Does not really make that much.
The thing that you're dealing with, in one sense, what you're dealing with in meditation is not so much the karma itself, but attachment, which means that, another word for good karma is merit. And merit has a habit of running out.
And it runs out, it doesn't seem to last anywhere near as long as the bad karma. You seem to have to give such a lot more merit than you do for...
7 times as much.
It would seem to be more than that periodically, but I agree with it. It really does run out awfully fast.
This is why in Buddhism there is a difference between what the Buddhist concept of heaven is and nirvana, because heavens are many different higher planes or different planes which one can enter as a result of merit. But if you just sit there and enjoy it, the merit runs out and plop, you drop down to something else. The point of meditation is something other than enjoyment or good.
And this is why you are looking for the cosmic Buddha, why you are looking for that which is unborn, undying, and uncreated, rather than finding a place where you can enjoy your merit. This is why you do not look for a heaven. You are looking for the place where that is permanent. If you go to a heaven, right, you can go to a heaven and have really terrific time. And when the merit runs out, or when you can no longer pay for the Holiday Inn, where do you go? Crash in somebody's head, I think, is the modern term for it. You've got to So long as you're paying for it in that sense, you can never have it permanently. But if you have found that which is unborn and undying, then it doesn't matter. You're not interested in happiness. There's no point to... Who would want happiness? A dog asleep in the sun is happy. If you can know ecstasy, who wants anything less? Anyway, you had a question.
Yeah. As we were talking, I realized what I was talking about, guilt, was associated with the idea of a smelly bag of fish. Is still to know that that smelly bag of fish still has within it purity. And that
the bag itself is a pure bag. All you have to do is wash out the smell. There's nothing wrong with the bag.
And that also is the smell, because that's what I get pushed, what I push myself into is being separate from. Anything, this idea of separate from, it's that eternal damnation that you're off of. And there's a part of the hand, I mean, the image that I take refuge in a lot is the one from Monkey, where Monkey flies around the hand and is still has not left.
He can never leave the cosmic Buddha, not even when he piddles on the cosmic Buddha's third finger and says, look at me, look what I can do. I just found the pillars of the universe and I just piddled on one. And the Buddha closes his hand on him and says, yeah, you just never left my hand, did you? And there's Monkey watching the piddle run down the cosmic Buddha's hand. Must have scared the living daylights out of it.
But it's that idea of not being outside of the hand, no matter what state.
No.
It's not to go along with it, but still that separateness.
We do have a problem in our way of life here in America, in that if something gets stained or dirty or is used, we think we should throw it away and get a new one. This one's had it. It's not. It's a habit of mine that I've tried to keep the monks out of in Shasta. Oh, no, 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 that can be reused. That's good. Let's use it. It's to get over the point that this has only got a perfume from the past. It does not damage the thing intrinsically. Mm-hmm. It's a very important point, that.
And also, there's something about the hate... The smell itself, or the fish, the dead fish, which is that it's like it needs to be cleaned, it needs to be purified, but it's not something that is inherently separate from the Buddha in one sense. It's like hate itself. What is hate? It's love standing on its head. You turn it around. And that is to purify it or to clean it. Because, you know, when you make
it
something...
It is also another version of turning the wheel.
Right.
Just as inhalation becomes exhalation, the turning of the wheel turns hate into love. The conversion of anger into compassion. And you have to find out what they all turn into. You do not get rid of anything. You wash it sufficiently to find out what its real potential is. You see, a person comes to me and says, I'm angry. What can I do about it? My job is then to teach him that anger is the other side of compassion and teach him how to get to compassion. I found that out years and years ago when I was teaching in a school in England. I've told this story many times, but it still comes in handy for this purpose. I'd come to the conclusion that if you shouted at somebody, then maybe they'd pay attention and do fine. Except that somebody who's both scared and stupid does a lot worse than somebody who's just plain stupid. So what I had to do was turn me around and have compassion. Instead of getting mad at the child for being dumb, I had to look at it and say, right, well, this child is not as bright as it could be. Now, that is not her fault. In other words, I had to have compassion for me so that I could have compassion for her. You had to turn the whole thing over. Now, all I had to work with was anger in me. I didn't throw the anger out. What can I do with what I've got is the answer.
How did you control it?
I couldn't stand the fright in the child's eyes. I got to do something. That poor child was going to be stuck with me till it was 14 at least by law. And if she could put up with it, I sure couldn't. It was that simple. In other words, I could not stand the way I was because of the effect it was having on somebody else. And that's really why we come to Zen. Really why you go to any church whatsoever, because you cannot stand the way you are. And you want to do something about it. And it can teach you how. Go ahead.
Just an extension of that. You have a feeling, an attitude towards a person that you really do not want to have. But
then you've got to start taking a really good, deep look at it. And meditation will help you to. The real tragedy is that most of it, what's going to come up, you're not going to like at all. Because you're going to see a side of you that you never knew existed. I never knew that I had a bad-tempered side until I was trying to get music through this kid's noddle. Of course, Mother Nature had not endowed her with being a musician. A point that I hadn't taken into consideration. I was young, but that's not an excuse. Yes, I was young, but I was inexperienced because I was young. You can't say I was young so it's an excuse for getting mad. You can say I was young so I am inexperienced, therefore I must gain experience, which is a totally different way of dealing with it. Anybody else got anything?
This anger, when anger comes out like energy, like pure energy, you know, it seems like it's, I recently had this experience, it felt like it was a clean kind of, you know, it wasn't like screaming and yelling and a big drama. It was like a, you know, it seemed really fine.
Did it do any harm to anyone? No. You see, enlightened action, what you're actually talking about now is what is enlightened action? Is it possible to be angry or is it not? And is it good to be angry or is it not? And what you have to take into consideration here is who benefits. Right. Then it's not enlightened action. Then however good it made you feel, it didn't do a real good job. There are three precepts, they call them precepts, I don't know any other term for them. After you have got over the, not after you've got over, these are the extensions of do not steal, don't murder, etc. There come three questions that you always have to ask yourself if you want to be sure that you're going to do an enlightened act. The first is, am I ceasing absolutely from evil if I do this thing? The second is, am I doing good and nothing other than good? And the third is, am I doing good for others? And if you can't get a yes to each one of those three questions, then you don't do it. You know, you've heard the old saying of count five before you lose your temper or before you slug somebody. This is the Buddhist equivalent of that. Well, I would have to know the circumstances, and I'm certainly not going to ask for them in public. I would have to know the circumstances to know the answer to that. But I would have said that someone could, after a lot of training, be able to have control over that. I didn't have control over it when I first lost my temper with this child that I spoke of, but I later did. And if I were to do it now, I would be thoroughly ashamed of myself. In fact, I wouldn't be fit to be a priest. But did I have the control over it then? The answer was no, because I didn't know how to do it any other way. Perhaps the answer to you, perhaps what you are saying is, you had something happen over which, at the time, you didn't think you had any control, but maybe 5-10 years from now, you will look back on, as I looked back on this. Do you think that's possible? Yeah. You have to look at it from a point of view of you are going to progress.
Could you describe the mind of a master meditator, what it would be like during meditation, that mind?
Once you have done it, nothing, once you have done it really, the whole way, nothing ever that the world regards as satisfactory can be satisfactory to you other than that. One of the things that proves that one has done it right is the fact that food is no longer of interest. It's after the taste of Dharma, nothing can be really tasty. You eat lest you become lean and die, but it is not, there is no real interest in the food. Sex does not arise at all, because after you have been possessed by Dharma, after you have known that love, there is no physical love with which compare it. There is no desire to study anything at a university or to gain knowledge, because after you have had knowledge of Dharma, there is nothing worth learning left. And so it goes on throughout one's entire life. So the life looks quite boring, but in fact it is a life of ecstasy. That's the only way I can tell you. Does that answer your question? Okay. It's rough on the way there. Very rough. Because you have to do so much you never believed was possible, and you have to do so many things that you never conceived of. Because there's a lot more to it than just what I've been talking about today. I always get worried on these first lectures because it's like diving into the deep end of a swimming pool that's about 50 fathoms deep and wondering what you're going to come up with on the first one, because you're really starting everybody from scratch and trying to take them down for a deep dive with you.
Is it possible to obtain that state? You know, people that have done that, and then because they've never been in a supportive community that would support that, have, you know, either worked on destroying themselves or destroyed that state because it was unacceptable by the society around them.
I can't say that I've met one, all right? I have not met all that large a number of people who have got that far in it. I have met a lot of people who have had what, for lack of better terminology, can be regarded as a first kensho, a first understanding. But many, many people have seen God. Very few of them have ever known what to do with it. Seeing him is one thing, and learning how to what to do with it and how to be worthy of it are two totally different things. In many respects, when somebody has had a first kensho, which is what a lot of Zen organizations regard as necessary for being qualified as a Roshi, is really a very unwise thing, because it's what he does after it that decides whether he or she is going to continue and to get to the state of what is called the third kensho, when you live, eat, drink, taste Dharma itself. Well, and it's very rough after the first one.
I guess that was more of the question I had. There's stages, I realize.
Yes.
Just some people that I have known, person I have known, let's put this way, seem to have attained an understanding. Let's say, okay. And was...
I have had people have first kenshos, and they have seemed to have an understanding, and I have known them go wrong. I have never known someone get to a top, a really good second or third, and have them go wrong. There's no way they could go wrong on a third. Just no way. You know the old story of the higher up the ladder, or the harder, the more you hurt yourself when you fall down it. Believe me, when you're that high up, you do not cling on. You're not going to let go under any circumstances. The difference would be you will plunge into the deepest hell in a very real sense, without ever going anywhere other than here. But yes, I've known people go back after a first, and they've been very, very grievously hurt inside in consequence. I don't know about your friend, but I've known that. Only twice, fortunately. Once with one of my own disciples, and once with someone who is now in Japan. Anybody else?
Well, I don't know. It seems like I have a feeling that there's sort of a risk involved. You said that you can't go back. And if your life is really rich and you are enjoying being really human and the good and bad of it and all of that, why would you want to take that risk of changing so much?
I should have brought Prakamun with me on that. Let's scare you into doing it, shall we? By all means, enjoy it all you wish. Supposing next time round you are not in the position you are in now. Because the merit does run out. You have to put so much into the bank if you would withdraw money. Now, if you are living on the merit now and you don't put anything in, eventually the merit will run out.
Well, how about waiting till the very end of your life? Which
is when?
And then doing a mystic cleanup.
Can I tell you
my
a story?
My fantasy is 85 or something.
It could be in 50 years or that could be in 5 minutes.
Right.
Can I tell you a story? There's a school of Buddhism which says that all you have to do to be born in the Western paradise is to repeat the name of the
Amida Buddha.
And someone asked a teacher, well, how soon before I die should I begin repeating the name? And he said, 24 hours. And then he said, how do I know when I die? He says, you don't. So you better start right now.
Better get moving.
You better get weaving. I can remember someone who shall be nameless, who got married, and who was thinking, well, now, I want to live the life of a householder. But you see, I also want the advantages of being a monk who is not married. Now, I worked it out that I could have my wife and children, and then three or four years before I die, I can come along and live a full life as a monk. So I said, great. When are you going to die? Well, I said, see, I won't be probably about 60 or 70. I said, but the way you drive a car, it's going to be remarkable if you make it back home. And he thought about this. Could be right. He still hasn't done anything. But to sit there calculating what the chances were, he then proceeded, to, as a mathematician, he proceeded to work out what the percentages would be of what was the likelihood of his being the one that would die on the freeway.
Would have been easier if you just started.
You see, you can't play that sort of game with the cosmic Buddha. It doesn't work. You've got no proofs of anything. I could go outside this building and I could be knocked down. I could go home and somebody could set light to the priory. Somebody did a few weeks ago. You have no proof of anything. This is what Dogen is talking about here. Nobody knows how long he's got to live. He'd have a heart attack tonight. That doesn't mean to say you've got to give up enjoying the merit you've got. It does mean put a little more in the bank just to keep some in there. Go ahead.
I would bring that to enlightened action.
Yes.
The three things, to cease absolutely from evil and am I doing good. I always had an idea somehow that the cosmic Buddha, as you term it, was like somewhere between here's good and here's evil. It's between, but this would seem to imply that it's somewhere beyond good.
It's beyond good and evil. It's right beyond good
but
and
it's
evil.
Of the way of good. It is
of the way of good.
Way.
Oh no, it's beyond good. Because without fail, evil is vanquished and good prevails. That is one of the five laws of the universe that I shall be talking about next week. Once